Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore the power of ideas to shape countries, foreign policies, international power structures, and indeed, the world. And first, how do regions develop resilience to manage conflicts and to ensure they don't spread to other countries? Doug Becker explores with Anna Ohanian.
I'm Doug Becker. Some regions of the world just seem rife with conflict. Others seem to be more stable. International relations scholarship tends to take a top-down approach in explaining these differences, often asking, is there a particularly strong state in a region that can maintain the peace within that region? Regional hegemony is the key. But our guest today argues for a more bottom-up approach, focusing on the bonding and bridging of communities that can determine how resilient or fractured a region is. This topic is particularly salient with conflicts brewing, for instance, all across the post-Soviet space, certainly Ukraine, but a lot of other areas in that post-Soviet space, in the Balkans, where it seems like that could potentially reignite, in Latin America, and certainly across Africa. In a new book, Anna Ohanian urges analysts to examine the construction of a region in a much more complex manner. On today's show, we interview Anna Ohanian about her new book, The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture. She is the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. Anna, thank you very much for joining us. I guess the first big broad question then is, you're taking on this question, why are some regions just more prone to conflict than others? So the first cut, what's your explanation for that?
Sure. Another way of thinking about that question, perhaps a bit more policy-oriented one, is how do regions pacify over time? And I have been looking at the regional fabric of politics for a while now. I started looking at the regional fabric of politics mostly as a tool of conflict management. But the more I was digging into it, the more I realized that there's a lot more going on. Obviously, most of the wars are expressions of neighbors threatening one another. These are conflict formations between contiguous states. So that's number one. Number two, there is also spillover of conflicts. Democracies tend to affect spillover regionally. Authoritarianism is also spilling over regionally. And there is vast literature on comparative regionalism, but much of that literature has been Eurocentric, to put it bluntly. The assumption being that to pacify a region, you need strong states, democratic and industrialized societies. So therefore, peaceful regions are the privilege of the rich European and industrialized world. And what I argue here is that to answer this question as to how regions pacify, we need to look at this from an imperial lens. What I argue is that regions come before states, meaning to have strong states, you have to look at the regional conditions from which they were born. And these regional conditions were mostly imperial peripheries. So this approach, which challenges the Eurocentric approach, argues that understanding the regional fabric of imperial peripheries, for example, the Bosnian province in the Habsburg Empire, Eastern Anatolia in the Ottoman Empire, Transcaucasia in the Russian Empire, that understanding these patterns of regional connectivity, understanding these peripheries, imperial peripheries, as political regions is crucial to assessing the chances of regional politics between nation states that grew out of these territories. I hope that answers the question, Doug.
Yeah. And then by peripheries, are you talking more geographic peripheries or how close they are to power? Yeah.
That's a great question. Actually, I'm so glad you asked that question. Both. I mean, peripheries are geographic constructs, but also they're political constructs. They're politically cultivated. For example, there have been a lot of concepts that describe some of these types of regions. There, for example, the concept of a shatter zone. Anatolia, Transcaucasia being a shutter zone, kind of being stuck between two empires and constantly being attacked by both sides. What I argue is that geographical location, contiguity of ethno-religious elements, obviously units, obviously is a factor, but these are politically constructed. They're made out of connections between this units. They're made out of the great power rivalries that plays out in these peripheries. So yes, I mean both.
Saying that this is kind of breaking out of a Eurocentric model, I find, you know, particularly fascinating. But in essence, what you're saying then is that the states themselves, because, I mean, those are created entities, that the regions and the emphasis on connectivity, on cultural similarities, on the bonds there, that perhaps there's a regional identity or regional identities that can help to build a kind of resilience for the region. Am I reading this correctly?
You're close. I wouldn't go so far as to say that there's a regional identity, that the regional identity is a necessary marker of resiliency. But what I am arguing is that various imperial peripheries, actually some fractured, some resilient, so they differed in how they were connected. On the one hand, most of these peripheries were multi-ethnic, but in some peripheries, you had ethno-religious groups, peripheries that were rich in what we know in political science, bonding social capital, meaning not only there were a lot of civic actors, but most of it was confined within ethnic groups, ethno-religious groups. But you also had peripheries where there was a lot of bridging social capital, also known concept in political science. And it is these types of bridging social capital that added was necessary, but not a sufficient condition of regional resiliency, where the magic happened really if the imperial center, if there's a large imperial construct, and I looked at the Habsburg, the Ottoman, and the Russian empires, if there were a national level, central level parliamentary institutions, representative institutions, where these bridging capital could be aired out, where there would be political space for bargaining, negotiation. And that level of politicking added greatly to the regional resiliency. So let me add something important that captures the core of this approach here. At the heart of it, this is a sort of a civic peace, civic connectivity argument. And there's such good scholarship on it. Varshney's book published several years ago on India is fabulous. Tora Wigg published on the importance of traditional institutions in pre-colonial African continent as necessary, actually consequential for contemporary armed conflict patterns or lack thereof in parts of Africa. So at the heart of it, this approach of regional connectivity is a social civic peace argument. However, it does offer a multi-level framework. It argues that imperial metropoles and their peripheries were co-constituted. And this approach allows to understand how regional level societal connectivity, fractured or resilient, interacted with great power rivalries. Meaning those communities that were rich in bridging social capital were much more effective in managing and pushing against great power rivalries, external that would play out in these peripheries, as well as the imperial stressors coming from the metropole. So this multi-level approach that tries to integrate macro level, great power level of analysis, as well as the regional connectivity is, I would say, is really important in this particular theoretical framework developed here.
Now, in the book, and what we've been talking about thus far, we've got this variable. What you want to understand is whether a region is resilient or is it fractured. Let's lay out, what exactly does that mean? Is it that if a conflict breaks out within the region, that conflict is more likely to spread because of a fracturing, you know, within the region, but resilience means it can kind of fight that off, maybe localize it, make sure that it doesn't spread? Is it deeper than that, or is that ultimately what we're talking about?
So the book has two broad takeaways. The first one is that it develops this framework to explain imperial peripheries as political regions. And in this, it actually pushes the comparative regional scholarship contemporary to be a little bit more historical. Much of that scholarship kind of looks at regionalism, comparative regionalism looks at developments after World War II. And what I argue, and again, it sees strong regions made up of stronger states and strong international organizations. This approach turns that upside down and says we have to understand the patterns of regional connectivity to understand their trajectory. But the second takeaway is to which you just alluded. It also makes a claim that this regional connectivity, this neighborhood effect, fractured or resilient, has enormous imperial legacies on how contemporary armed conflict either played, manifested or not. And the key juncture here is the end of the Cold War. So what I argue, so this is that there is a conflict theory in this book. So what I argue is that the end of the Cold War was that period was a critical juncture because it sort of, there was this geopolitical thaw and then that warming of relations, the rest of the world was marveled at how peaceful the Soviet collapse was. And then the East and the West, the Russia and the Western Bloc never collided. And the world was so happy about it. In parallel, so there was one narrative, but in parallel, there were all of this, which are usually described as post-Soviet wars, which were essentially did not register in terms of their severity. They were not connected to this great power theory, this peaceful collapse narrative. So the theories have been bifurcated, which I think theoretically, as well as in policy terms, is problematic. In terms of the conflict theory, I argue that looking at the end of the Cold War, understanding why some conflicts erupted right away, meaning the onset is one dimension, was very quick. The second one is the severity. So if you look at the post-communist Eurasian space, and I also included the Kurdish conflict in Turkey, which became the dynamic shifted with the end of the Cold War, it becomes clear that the Balkan War, the Balkan Yugoslav disintegration was very bloody, it was quick, so was the unraveling of the South Caucasus. But yet the Baltics emerged quite peacefully, even though this was also a multi-ethnic periphery within the Russian Empire in the pre-Soviet years. So from the conflict perspective, I push back against the description of this conflict as post-Soviet wars. And I do realize there's vast literature on this as to how Soviet ethno-federalism played a role in ethno-federalism played a role in this manifestation of this conflict. But I argue that this post-Soviet wars had pre-Soviet imperial roots. And this book is an attempt to provide an answer as to how these mechanisms were baked into the ethno-federal system and how they are reverberating.
So in essence, and again, two key points that you're trying to explain, why the wars break out so quickly and then how intense they were, whether they spread. So your main argument here is that the Russians had this influence in the Baltics, but also in the South Caucasus, but the South Caucasus region explodes and the Baltics don't because of imperial legacies, correct?
Exactly. And this is really important because when we look at the Eurasian continent, we kind of have so-called what I call the Kremlin blinders on. We look at the continent from the perspective of the Kremlin, and obviously Russia is engaged in this devastating war of choice, of conquest in Ukraine. But at the same time, looking at the continent only from the Russia perspective misses a lot of narrative, misses a lot of politics. There have been a variety of explanations as to why there was the Balkans has reintegrated, was so peaceful, it emerged so peacefully from the end of the Cold War. There's some arguments that it had a shorter span as part of the Soviet Union. So this approach offers an alternative explanation. We often forget. Historians obviously have done a wonderful job in answering these questions, but I do think that political science has been slow to catch up, meaning that Russia had obviously territorially vast. So it was conspicuous by just the sheer size of the empire, multi-ethnicity. And throughout its political history, the imperial center had engaged, mostly tolerated different forms of political systems around its peripheries. It was a very multi-ethnic state, but it also on occasion periodically has used Russification policies. As with all empires, Russia had this dilemma. On the one hand, to modernize the same way as the Ottoman and Habsburg Empire were trying, Russia had to modernize. It was tempted, it was driven to centralize its governance. But when trying to centralize and make governance uniform, it ended up losing the signature strategy, which is differential contracting, meaning you offer something to one periphery, something different to another, and giving this informal bargaining gives you leverage over your peripheries. So it's not surprising that the imperial pattern of governance, the signature of imperial governance in its western frontiers, in the Ukrainian lands, as well as in the Baltic areas, was different than, let's say, in South Caucasus, contemporary South Caucasus, or contemporary Central Asia. So the book argues that the political violence trajectory or lack thereof after the Cold War might have to do with how the Russian Empire had structured its relationships with these peripheries.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing Anna Ohanian's new book, The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Eurasia, with the author, Anna Ohanian. So part of what you're describing here then is the need to have a richer understanding of the ways in which the regions were constructed and those interactions within the region. I think from my reading of this, it seems that in essence, one of the key questions was how well integrated the regions were, this notion of resilience versus fractured, or how divided those regions are, helps to explain not just the outbreak of conflict, but whether the conflict spreads, becomes particularly bloody, and isn't terribly managed. And if that's the case, then the policy implication would seem to suggest a regional approach to conflict resolution that isn't necessarily based on who's the powerful country who can step in and put down the conflict, but instead really about the interactions, within the region. And so, is that correct? And if so, things like regional organizations would seem to play a pretty key role in trying to build a resiliency of a region by trying to build those connections. Is that the argument you're making, or am I missing?
No, you're correct. I mean, that's part of the argument that I'm making. I mean, the book has a policy chapter 8, I think, peace by proxy. So essentially, yes, on the one hand, from the perspective of conflict management, the field of conflict analysis and resolution, it's a relatively young field, and it's a very applied field, and it's notorious for being very ahistorical. There's very little analysis as to how traditional societies, traditional institutions, in this case, it would be imperial pre-Soviet institutions, actors engaged in conflict management. The assumption is that they did not, and then that conflict management is sort of this Western invention and intervention, the liberal peace and all of it. The research that I did, and that which is actually one of the policy implications that emerged from the book, is that actually, for example, in the Transcaucasian periphery, there were communal conflicts. It was a region that was heavily affected by the Armenian genocide in the neighboring Ottoman Empire. But at the same time, this region is one of hybridity. In parallel to the communal clashes, there was actually extraordinary level of peacemaking happening between the communal leaders, between Armenians, Georgians, and Caucasian Tatars at the time. They were known as contemporary Azerbaijanis. And these communal leaders actually treated the communal violence as a problem to be managed. And we just do not know enough as to how this historically, these traditional institutions, these community leaders coexisted, managed their conflicts within an imperial periphery. My 2018 book, the edited volume on Russia, actually starts with this stark example of an Armenian writer, which I, growing up in Soviet Union, I didn't know that this Armenian writer, Hovhannes Tumanyan, was this big peacemaker at the time. He was imprisoned twice in the Russian Empire. For what? For engaging in peacemaking activities. So he was imprisoned by Nicholas II, for specifically by the Tsar, for engaging in this peacemaking activity. So that's one aspect of the policy implications. But more importantly, the second component, which you described, it does refer to the need of regional institutions. Now, there's a lot of scholarship on the importance of regional organizations, enhancing regional organizations, conflict management capacities. But when you look at some of these conflict regions, most of the policymakers, especially politicians from these regions, there's this constant chase for patrons, alliances, the assumption that this hegemonic peace, stability is always sought, that either two powers will balance each other in a particular region, extra regional powers will influence and provide stability, or one regional hegemon will maintain stability. But that's simply deterrence. That's not sustainable security. That's not workable peace. You did read the book correctly that, yes, I do advocate for multi-level security approaches, meaning building security from the bottom up. Non-conflict and peace scholarship has a lot of data now available. There, we know a lot about best practices in peace building and inclusive building peace processes that are inclusive, that are diverse, that are multi-layered. These are all things that we know. How to incentivize regional connectivity, the sort of the familiar free trade, open borders, connectivity, all of that is important. But I think regional diplomatic structures also need to be developed, especially for small states. What I argue in the policy chapter is this phenomenon of fortress politics. Many post-Soviet states suffer from this condition, I would argue. This assumption that I don't have to rely too much on my neighborhood, especially in the post-conflict period. This hyper-globalization, multipolarity sort of pushed the states, incentivized them to try to integrate with these large blocs, with these distant capitals, and which often came at the expense of their immediate neighborhoods. Well, the data shows that for a state to develop economically, they do need to be in a stronger neighborhood. It is going to matter for a single state that your neighbor is doing well economically. Chances of you staying peaceful does depend whether your neighbors are fighting or not. So these are all regional factors, but much of the diplomacy in the post-communist states in Russia's periphery suffers from the paucity, from the sparseness of regional structures of diplomacy. There's very little regional connectivity in these areas.
And it seems like then some of the takeaways, first of all, there's been this tremendous hand-wringing about the potential for conflict in the post-Soviet space, with Russia being co-opted, first of all, being distracted as a result of its invasion of Ukraine, and so simply not having resources, or at least not having the interest in playing this, you know, this peacekeeping role. But also there's going to be a huge legitimacy crisis, you know, as a result. And then add to that other regions that immediately come to mind, Francophone African states, with the assumption that, you know, the peace building has to come from France, has to come from this powerful country that can try to put this down. The role that the U.S. has played, you know, Latin America, you know, for example, what you're suggesting, first of all, is that's kind of a wrongheaded approach, that it's really about the most powerful country coming in. But I guess, secondly, for those of us interested in conflict resolution, peace building, et cetera, the argument this really needs to be built from the ground up. And so, though you can't snap your fingers, send a peacekeeping force, and suddenly the war is going to end, if you are interested in more stable peace, it really is about these kinds of, you know, perhaps even non-state or sub-state peace-building measures, building regional connections, building religious connections, building identity connections, all of those, that being the policy. So those of us interested in peace-building, stop focusing top-down, focus bottom-up. Is that...
Exactly. Exactly. You're spot on. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you say, are you does that make you more optimistic about peace building within the regions, less optimistic, or just grateful that we're starting to focus on what the real issues are?
In a way, I feel optimistic simply because there's so much low-hanging fruit. There is so much from this regional frame that has not been tried. Indeed, the people in conflict regions do tend to look for this external patron, whether it's a hegemon that can come to provide security cover or peacekeeping, which of course, obviously is very important, peacekeeping for moving, creating the political space for peace processes. But at the same time, there's great power involvement provides some stability at most, but it does not trickle down into transforming the context around the conflict. And the regional approach that needs to be deployed, regional connectivity that needs to be deployed, is crucial in transforming the context around a particular conflict. If you're looking in South Caucasus, for example, the Russia negotiated agreement, right, the ceasefire agreement that ended the 44-day war in November 9, it has this component of regional unblocking. On one hand, I was really surprised that Russia would have this very liberal clause over there. But obviously this was now we're seeing how, number one, either Russia was unwilling to implement that agreement, or actually Russia does have a doctrine of conflict management, but what it essentially amounts to that Russia does use unresolved conflicts as a way to project its influence. That is not to say that, let's say, Western powers are so objective or neutral when it comes to interventions as third party players. But I think Russian case stands out because Russia has been using this peace processes to its advantage. I mean, Russia is interested now, especially after the Russian intervention in Ukraine, in unblocking regions and having a route. But now there's a lot of skepticism in Armenia against Russia, that Russia is essentially canoodling with Aliyev. So essentially trying to create a corridor and take a bite of Armenia's territorial sovereignty, and what Azerbaijan gets, even though Armenia had said, I'm opening the borders to Azerbaijan. Of course, easy connectivity to Nakhichevan. So it's not even an issue. It should be win-win for all involved. But if you're looking at how this particular agreement, the politics surrounding it, what becomes clear is that you have two illiberal powers. For them, it's about corridors, not connectivity. So what we see is the danger of very illiberal powers in mediating roles, third party roles, in this case, Russia, and either lacking the capacity to advance this, or just not wanting to do it on its terms. Russia's conflict management doctrine is all about Russia maintaining control through the peace process, is maintaining control over territories. So that is where we are. As for Aliyev, I think Aliyev does not want connectivity. And it's not just because he's singularly evil. I don't know the man. But for leaders in authoritarian oil-rich societies, where the oil is being depleted, by the way, where this is a country that is not rich in the language of economists, contract-intensive economy. This is not a contract-intensive economy. This is a patrimonial economy, meaning few segments within the society benefit by their access to the state. And the government, to maintain control of the rest of the society, has to use xenophobic nationalism and suppressing any opposition to maintain everybody within this particular political economy. So the takeaway from this work for regions like this is that, yes, when you do build peace processes, paying attention to most representative, most participatory connections, regional connectivity that is developmental, that is diverse, that empowers economically a lot of segments, that is a huge step towards building peace processes that will work.
The title of the book is The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture. The author is Anna Ohanian. She is the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. Thank you very much for joining us.
When we come back, the power of ideas to shape countries, foreign policies, and the world. Stay tuned.
Everything in life is a negotiation.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. How do ideas shape political realities? How do they interact with other, more concrete factors to drive political agendas and then shape countries and international relations? How might the reinterpretation or misinterpretation of these ideas and concepts change the course of history? We're joined by three experts. Elizabeth Borgwart is a professor at Washington University and the University of Chicago. She is author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law, and Politics. Tim Lynch is professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He is author of a number of publications, including Turf War, the Clinton Administration in Northern Ireland, and the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy. Christopher McKnight Nichols is a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and professor of history at Oregon State University. He is author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. The main purpose of this is to look at this evolution of U.S. foreign policy and how we got to where we are today. And each of you have looked at this different eras and also from different approaches. And I thought one of the places to start would be with Liz Borgwart. You've led one of your articles with how ideas themselves affect the future.
And it's not so much ideas on their own, but ideas as energizing institutions, as energizing individuals or social movements, the way ideas connect and interact with other factors. I think the classic image is the sociologist Max Weber saying that ideas are never going to be the coal that fires the engine of that train of history, but they can be the tracks that the train goes on. And obviously, where the tracks are really affects what the destination is, that you where you wind up.
I'm going to ask you to give some examples in a minute, but I think maybe where we should start in looking at that is Chris McKnight Nichols. You have looked at these concepts, ideas, and their interpretations of, say, isolationism, internationalism, and how much people's ideas about the ideas have affected what the United States has become as a world player and how that has, of course, affected the rest of the world, starting with maybe even the founders.
I agree with Liz Borgwart that ideas really matter, and ideas may matter in some ways more in foreign policy. So I would start with sort of two maybe fundamental precepts of that, that on the one hand, ideas matter to the masses. This is true from 1776 as it is to now. That is, sort of mass ideologies legitimize the roles that policymakers can take on. And then ideas clearly matter to the policymakers themselves. They frame the tracks. They frame the system of how individuals and groups, the train of state, to continue that metaphor, where it can go. So just to lay out a few of the more specific yet abstract ideas that have informed sort of revolutionary policymakers and others, there's always been a kind of ideological fervor and what you might call a messianic streak in American foreign policy. And you might also note then, too, that there's been something that we are really recently, historians and individuals throughout the world are greatly interested in, and that is kind of thinking about what Jefferson called in the Declaration of Independence, decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Now, certainly, American foreign policy hasn't always, or perhaps even often, cared that much about the respect for the opinions of mankind, but that has also been a major part of American foreign policy making. And I would add as well, pragmatism, or sort of a more diminished form of pragmatism, that is a willingness to compromise and achieve vital goals, has been something that unites Washington, Adams, Jefferson, to far later followers in their footsteps, like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and others.
It seems like in your book that it's also the reinterpretation of those original concepts that have shaped eras and directions. Like, what do they really mean? So the meanings about the concepts.
Absolutely. There may be sort of nothing more American than a sort of a sensibility of the nation's own exceptionality, which is often referenced through the early American Republic, the early history of the Republic. In terms of foreign policy, my work, I single out three what I call policy pillars. Those are Washington's farewell address in 1796, Jefferson's first inaugural address in 1801, and the Monroe Doctrine of 1823. And these are referenced for virtually every policymaker thereafter, regardless of the direction they want to take the country. They try to update the model of steering clear of foreign entanglements, to paraphrase, for each era.
It seems like we've gone quite a ways in the other direction from that. Tim Lynch, let's bring you in.
Well, I'd agree with much of that. I think it's worth restating that the United States is an idea. There is no United States until they have a revolution predicated on this idea. We know that other nations have had revolutions and have been animated by some very profound ideologies and very problematic ones, but the nation predates them. So if you looked at the English Revolution, the French, the Russian, the Chinese, these revolutions don't create the nation. America is created by its idea, by its ideology. And as a consequence, it's more prone, in this sense, I think it is exceptional, it's more prone to ideological behavior and ideational discourse than most other nations, even though these other nations have had very well-defined periods of ideological behavior. You think of the Nazis, you think of fascism, communism, whereas the United States has this ideology, but in some strange way, it's become powerful as a state because of its pragmatism as well as its ideology. It's understanding how these two things relate to each other and balance each other, complement each other, that is necessary for explaining the overall success of of American foreign policy over the long term.
And you say success of American foreign policy, which I'm assuming you mean by the U.S. becoming such a large global player in the world.
I think it's a very simple metric, and even those that have a downer on current expression of American power, it's gone from being a diddly squat trading outpost on the eastern seaboard of British North America to being not just an important global power, but the most powerful nation in world history. Now, I know geography has something to do with that, and climate and the absence of neighbors, et cetera, but it also has something to do with its foreign policy and how it's dealt with the world. All the other competitor states, Russia, China, Britain, France, Spain, they all had notions, universalist notions of their model, and they've become not irrelevant to world history, but they played a secondary role. And we can debate how far this is going to endure, but the American system prospered. It went from nothing to really being everything, whilst the competitors failed. And I think that's got something to do with its foreign policy.
She makes a fascinating series of points about American exceptionalism, which has been very much in the news of late. And, you know, it reminds me of the opposition between traditional ideas about American exceptionalism, that it had a lot to do with having a frontier, for instance, the famous Frederick Jackson Turner thesis from the previous century, and the idea that because of the frontier, Americans could sort of remake themselves at any given moment. And then you have more modern ideas about American exceptionalism, like the, I know I'm quoting so many sociologists today, but Seymour Martin Lipset saying, you know, there's a basket of values that can be considered quintessentially American, notably individualism, and that if you subscribe to these values, that makes you American, because it's an ideationally oriented idea, American exceptionalism. It's not just that, there are frontiers other places too, right? Brazil had a frontier. Russia had a frontier. So maybe these ideas about being separated by oceans and having frontiers are necessary but not sufficient. maybe even similarly with having a revolution. But some of the ideas that Tim is talking about synthesize to make, what's the difference that makes a difference, I think is an exciting question.
That would bring in the question of these ideologies and how they have shaped the direction of leadership. For example, Liz, you talked about FDR advancing the human rights movement without really meaning to.
Right. It's much in the way that Professor Chris Nichols just articulated. In my book, I also use as a jumping off point a particular document. It was called the Atlantic Charter of 1941. It's not nearly as well known as the documents that Chris just referenced. But basically, it was a statement of war and peace aims. And what's cool about that is that it was negotiated in August of 1941, which is, of course, before the United States is in the war, right? So it's before Pearl Harbor. So what is FDR doing, negotiating with Churchill a set of aims for the post-war, you know, what the world is going to look like after this war is over that the United States isn't even in yet. And human rights were central to that vision in a way that went beyond just sort of generalizing the rights that we find, for instance, in the U.S. Bill of Rights.
Chris McKnight Nichols, let's bring you back in. And in addition to this trajectory, I'm also curious about the sort of ebb and flow that you noted in your book, particularly with the anti-imperialists and the isolationists who are pacifists, and how they have shaped or not shaped really where we are today.
So one thing that I often point out when I talk about my work on the subject is that humanitarianism is a relatively newcomer to the ideology, foreign policy kind of nexus. And it's the first moments of thinking about humanitarian intervention in the American context come with America's rise to world power in the late 19th century. And in particular, the sort of prism there is about the Spanish-American War and Spanish atrocities against Cubans. But of course, there's a notable blind spot as well that we see emerging right at that very first sort of genesis moment, and that is a blind spot towards American, not particularly humane activities, say in the Philippines and other words. For instance, the advent of waterboarding in American military affairs is actually in the context of the counterinsurgency against Filipino revolutionaries. But in terms of the ebb and flow here, you have from the late 19th century through the present, I hate to call it poles, but you see sort of hybrids of different visions. So on the one hand, you have those who oppose interventions abroad, generally speaking, and others who embrace them on a wide array of terms. So what I try to do in my book is to show the genesis of modern ideas about isolationism and show their actual relationship to new visions of internationalism. So, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s, you have fascinating alliances between so-called isolationists, like the Republican senator from Idaho, William Borah, a staunch isolationist, the so-called irreconcilable, with pacifist internationalists like the settlement house worker and reformer Jane Addams and Emily Balch, the first two women, actually, first two American women to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And they worked together for the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928 to outlaw war, for example. So what this shows us, I think, is that isolationism and internationalism were less of a binary and could often be combined in how Americans, policymakers and activists thought about their nation's role in the world.
Tim Lynch.
I'd agree with that. In some ways, these stereotypically oppositional concepts of isolationism and interventionism are both products of exceptionalism. You seek American isolationism because America is special and different and shouldn't be sullied by contact with the outside world. And by using the same rationale, you demand intervention to make the world in America's image. There's a common core. I mean, I think in some ways, and perhaps I don't want to overplay this, but there's a far greater complementarity in some of these quite differing understandings of what the nature of American power is, which has actually been very helpful in crafting what I've described as an effective foreign policy over the long term. Other nations tend to get sucked into very contrasting positions. I don't want to overuse the German analogy, but clearly in its history, it's had periods where it's looked outwards and periods where it's looked inwards, and these have had a markedly different impact on the quantum of German power. Whereas in the American case, America has got stronger in some ways because of the interplay of these two forces that seemingly pull it in the opposite direction. I'm partial to Walter Russell Mead's model. He outlines these four different foreign policy traditions, but his point is not that they are separate and distinct and cause dissensus and schizophrenia, that they work together over the long term. And that's why you're obliged to account for more success in the American story than you are its absence.
Given where we are today, and given this ideology and the idea and hope that the U.S. is actually a moral place, and the contradictions with things like what Chris mentioned in terms of the torture and the waterboarding and the massive amounts of deaths that have come as a result of some of the foreign policies, how do we reconcile the ideas and the rhetoric with the reality? Liz Borgwardt, I'm going to throw this to you.
Rhetoric can very often bootstrap reality. It's not a static snapshot of the relationship of rhetoric and reality. When I talk about that very aspirational document I just mentioned, the Atlantic Charter of 1941, you know, I'm sometimes asked when I speak about it, well, was it rhetoric or was it reality? And I feel like, well, what should I say? That it was, you know, 75% rhetoric and 25% reality. And like, that's the answer. No, I mean, when ideas are put out there, they inspire people, they change behavior, people get together, they form groups, they pressure decision makers, and it sort of circles back to, there's a sort of human impulse to reduce cognitive dissonance, I think, by sometimes slightly bringing the rhetoric and the reality into closer alignment. And one quick example that I would give would be, because we're historians, right, I'm going to give a historical example, but from the mid-70s, when the United States was negotiating with the then-Soviet Union in Helsinki, Finland, and you had this Helsinki Accord that was supposedly toothless and had all these human rights provisions. That's why the Soviets agreed to it, because there were no enforcement provisions. But it sparked, in many ways, a human rights revolution, because people started to believe that, you know, these Helsinki watch groups sprung up all over the world, all over Eastern Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, people started writing, you know, poems about human rights and having human rights plays in their basement. And the rhetoric, in effect, changed the reality because it reshaped people's perceptions and expectations and even their culture.
Did we also see that here within the U.S., Chris McKnight-Nichols?
Absolutely. I'm struck both by the fact that rhetoric does play out in altering the terms of politics, domestic as well as foreign policy. So one connection here that we haven't yet made is between domestic and foreign policy. That is, used to be said that partisan politics stopped at water's edge. This was a classic phrase that policymakers noted. And yet, in fact, as we all know as citizens and as human beings, we tend to frame political rhetoric and political decision-making in terms of both domestic and foreign. That is, one of the ways in which we think many individuals debated the Iraq War and the yearly costs of the Iraq War was to think in terms of limited resources and the fact that roughly the yearly burn rate for the first four years or so was something in the order of $30 to $35 billion a year. That happens to be about the same amount as universal health care. Now, we know this is a false quid pro quo, but thinking about the rhetoric of foreign policy, of these commitments abroad, often has a domestic reference. So, for example, thinking back in the past, the racial reformer W.E.B. Du Bois argued that, quote, civilization begins at home, that the kind of rhetoric of civilizing other peoples and other nations, the sort of manifest destiny justifications that American policymakers were putting forward, in fact, had a clear corollary at home, and that is you can't go abroad to enact civilization and fulfill American democratic ideals until you fulfill them at home.
It's interesting you'd say that. I've heard many political scientists actually make that remark about exporting democracy. Well, why don't we fix ours first? And that sounds like the place to bring in Tim Lynch.
I think it's a good question, but if you make your foreign interventionism contingent on your domestic perfection, then you won't do anything. America would be a big insular power. We know it acts highly imperfectly, but on balance over the long term, what we've tended to prosper by, and by prosper I mean the delivery of freedom to people around the world, has been the product in the last 100 years of the application of American hard military power. Europe wouldn't exist in the form it does. Japan wouldn't exist in the form it does had America not waged war on them and in them. So I think in some ways this notion that you can replace this basic currency, hard American military power, with something nicer, a softer version, is problematic and not borne out by the historical record. So I think it's all very well to build a vocabulary of human rights and to trace this lineage, which I think is long and a very worthwhile thing to do. But we forget that the notion of human rights is contingent on their enforcement through power, through hard military power. And in the 20th century, that job has fallen to the United States.
I think many people would argue that there may have been excessive force in most of these cases in which there was so much loss of human life and other very important aspects of humanity that it's hard to justify the other side.
Well, I think it's an argument worth having.
So, Elizabeth Borgwart, let's bring you back in on this.
Again, historians never like to talk very much about the future, but I think that this idea of, I'm so happy that Professor Lynch was talking about power, because I think a lot of particularly human rights specialists sort of shy away from these kinds of terms, and even in international relations, it's how do you talk about the interaction of, say, power and culture. I was talking about the Helsinki effect, so-called, earlier from that 1975 moment of having an ideology, inspire a social movement that then led to changed expectations and reconfigured politics. But we could even look now at, for instance, the Arab Spring. Who knows what the future of Arab Spring is? But it strikes me as patronizing to say, human rights are a Western construct. They're not for you because they're not indigenous. So, why don't you come up with some other way of framing your aspirations? Young people in the different Arab Spring movements have taken these ideas that maybe were publicly articulated in a more Western idiom initially, but they've really made them their own.
In terms of the concepts we're talking about, bring in the concept that Joseph Nye uses, soft power, persuasive power, power of ideas. How does that fit in with American history, Chris McKnight-Nichols?
It strikes me that both Tim's and Liz's points here intersect with another interesting aspect of American ideology in terms of foreign policy, and that is the ways, the sort of unintended consequences that American policymakers' rhetoric can entail. So a great example, Liz's work, for example, on the Atlantic Charter, and which she calls sort of a New Deal for the World, emerging even before America begins to fight the Second World War, or thinking about some of the paradoxical ways that isolationism emerges as something that cuts short annexations abroad, or American interventionism in my work. Or another example that comes to mind is Erez Manella's book, The Wilsonian Moment, which details how in Egypt, India, China, Korea, and beyond, sort of Woodrow Wilson's ideas about the 14 points, his call for a free, open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment of colonial claims, often configured as self-determination, really resonated with nationalists around the world in ways that Wilson himself didn't foresee and didn't particularly like. So some of the ways in which American foreign policy ideology plays out can be problematic, but actually can also be deeply empowering on a world stage.
Sometimes leaders say things and mean something completely different. And I think, Liz Borgwart, that was one of the things that you wrote about, that it is interpreted in one way, whereas the leader means something completely different. Perhaps look at what the underlying intentions sometimes are. It sometimes is this rhetoric of human rights really an excuse for building power or building economic superiority or something to that effect? What do you think?
Well, I'm often asked variations of the question, aren't human rights just a mask for imperialism? And, it reminds me, it's a sort of international version of when I'm asked about, I often teach about the New Deal, and so the question will be, wasn't the New Deal just a mask for stabilizing capitalism? And with both of those questions, for me, the key word is the word just, because it was that, but it was some other things too, and so too with human rights, where there are moments of great fluidity in international politics where you can have things can be tugged in a somewhat more progressive direction. And you mentioned leaders meaning something different. I mean, that classic example in my book is the arch-imperialist Churchill, you know, articulating some of the most highfalutin phrases in the Atlantic Charter about all the men in all the lands living out their lives in freedom from fear and want. That's actually, he was paying a compliment to FDR by sort of quoting Roosevelt back to himself. But he was then asked in the British House of Commons if that applied to British colonial possessions in India and Africa. And he stood up and said, you know, I didn't become the king's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. I meant it for an inspirational value to help bring the United States in to support us.
Chris McKnight-Nichols.
It strikes me that ideological positions have remained relatively fluid in American foreign policy, but there are some strong examples of those from Jefferson and Madison responding to British trade restrictions in the early 19th century, or Wilson in the League of Nations. When American policymakers have refused to compromise, they've met defeat. But you've also had examples, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's kind of realism, sometimes described as amoral realism, also couldn't really survive indefinitely without firmer foundations in maybe the nation's more, what we might call, more well-revered past principles. So it seems to me that we're struck with a kind of deep paradox about ideology in American foreign policy, that perhaps the most widespread belief, something that we've all been talking about today, is that American foreign affairs is a peculiar aspect of American history and that it has a sort of exceptionalist model. This is something that foreign policymakers have almost always wanted to attend to. And yet, the American public, at least historically, hasn't made many demands on policymakers to get deeper inside their ideologies, to understand more fully what ideologies guide our foreign policies. And so I wonder, as an open question in the 21st century, whether or not the American people, in terms of democratic accountability, will ask more about the ideologies of their presidents in terms of foreign policy.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you to the three of you, Elizabeth Borgwardt, professor of history at Washington University and University of Chicago, and author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law and Politics. Tim Lynch, professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at University of Melbourne, author of publications including Turf War, the Clinton Administration in Northern Ireland, and also the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy, and Christopher McKnight-Nichols, who's been with us once before, who is at the University of Pennsylvania and a professor of history at Oregon State University, author of Promise in Peril, America at the Dawn of the Golden Age. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Great.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.